We're under the gun. I feel it. There's only 3 days left. I have to cover everything else about Beyond the Standard Model Physics in that time. So today we're going to do the strong CP problem. Okay, so what it is and what the proposed solutions for it are. Okay, so for starters, so recall our Lagrangian for the standard model. So there were all the bosonic terms, the first two lines in the action, kinetic term for the scalar, for the gauge bosons, and then the kinetic terms for the Higgs field and its potential terms, and then there were the kinetic terms for the fermions. That was the third line, and then we had this fourth line where a lot of the action took place, the Yukawa couplings. And remember, we, by soaking up phases into redefinitions of the fields, we managed to write it in this form, unitary matrix, the CKM matrix, times a positive diagonal real matrix, Y sub D, times the Higgs times the right-handed down quark, plus another analogous term for the right-handed up quark, but with no CKM matrix in it, plus a term for the lepton, for the leptons, coupling the left-handed lepton coupling to the right-handed electron, and then plus, not dot, 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 plus Hermitian conjugate. And then there were the theta terms. We said in principle we could write down theta terms for topological terms for each of the gauge fields. Okay, one for theta 3, one for theta 2. And one for theta 1. Where remember that the notation here is that G twiddle is the dual of G, et cetera. So for example, G twiddle of mu nu is equal to A is equal to the epsilon tensor mu nu rho sigma contracted with G of rho sigma A. So that's like a transformation that over here, the zero I components were the basically electric fields, and the ij components were the magnetic fields. And then those get permuted when we do this duality transformation. So in G twiddle zero I are the fields we used to call the magnetic fields over here, and G twiddle ij are the fields we used to call the electric fields over here. Okay, now, and remember we soaked up as many phases as we could here, and at the end of the day, we were able to make the little y matrices all real and positive and diagonal. VCKM was a unitary matrix, but we soaked most of the free parameters out of it so that there ended up being three real rotation angles that mixed, rotated, connected, you know, flavor one over here to flavor two or three over here, et cetera. And then one complex phase, which, and then the idea was that we had argued that, so the remaining symmetries here were that we had this overall baryonic phase that we could, where we could send every q left to the same e to the I phi times q left, and we could send every d right to the same e to the I phi d right, and every u right to the same e to the I phi u right. So every one of the quark fields transforms with the same phase, and that leaves all of these matrices invariant. That's the so-called baryon number symmetry of the standard model. And then similarly, there were three analogous phases. We could separately rotate each of the three lepton left flavors by a phase and rotate the corresponding E right flavor by the same phase. So there were three more global symmetries left here, the three lepton numbers, first generation, second generation, and third generation lepton numbers. And anyway, using any one of those phases, we saw that we could rotate this guy away. Remember that the story was because those phases act differently on the left and right-handed fermions, there's an anomaly, and so they generate a term just like this. And so by rotating by the right amount, we can cancel this term. So really, secretly, this phase is unphysical. This term is unphysical. But we saw that we could not use those let's get rid of that. But we saw that we could not use those phase rotations to get rid of either this term or this term. So the strong CP problem will be all about how if that term is non-zero, it predicts a non-zero electric dipole moment for the neutron, which we don't observe. So you have to figure out why it's actually zero, even though it seems like it should be there. But before we do that, let's just make one more comment about this guy. The theta one theta that theta one term has become like an unexpected star of this course. I think it's a pretty interesting term I had never paid any attention to. So let me just say just a couple of words about that. So like all of these terms, this one is a total derivative. So you can write this thing as if you just take that expression and use the fact that the B mu's use the expression for B mu nu as D mu times the gauge field B nu minus D nu times the gauge field B mu, you'll see that you can rewrite this thing as epsilon mu nu rho sigma times B nu partial rho B sigma. And so, like with all three of these terms, that means that this term will not contribute to the equations of motion for the theory. When you're varying B to get the Euler-Lagrange equation for B, you include this term or you don't include it, nothing happens because the variation for B here will just integrate away by parts. But to see how it can have a physical effect, imagine for a moment that theta is not constant. Okay, imagine that you let theta be a function of space and time, and now let's redo the derivation of the Euler-Lagrange equations. Okay, and in fact, let me just forget about the rest of the standard model. By the way, I should say, if you're interested in this topic, there's a very nice set of lecture notes by David Tong about gauge theory, and the first chapter of that deals with exactly this theta term for electromagnetism. And in fact, for the time being, let's just forget about all the other terms in the standard model and just focus on the two kinetic terms for B. So that parity violating term, and then the normal kinetic term for B, which just looks like the ordinary Maxwell term. So then it's just like ordinary electromagnetism. It's just a U1 gauge theory. And so I'll call the zero I components of this thing E in the usual notation and the IJ components B, the electric and magnetic fields. So, you know, what do the, so you end up getting, you know, not, when you vary and you allow theta to be non-constant, you get not quite the normal Maxwell equations. Instead, you find the these modified Maxwell equations where okay, so these are normally the these are the usual source-free Maxwell equations that come from the fact that taking that if A is a one form and F is D of that one, if the gauge field B is a one form, okay. Sorry. Let's just to not confuse notation. Let's say I'm talking about. Okay. In the standard model, this field is called B mu. But let's talk about the analogous term for electromagnetism to not confuse things. So theta electromagnetism over 16 pi squared times the electromagnetic gauge coupling, and then times we would have F mu nu twiddle, or F mu nu is equal to d mu a nu, the photon, minus d nu a mu. So, you know, there's the two source-free Maxwell equations where you just say, okay, if a is a one form and f is the exterior derivative of that one form, it's a two form. If you take d of that again, that's so there's the Bianchi identity. Okay, so these are the ones that come from the Bianchi identity. And then there are the sourced Maxwell equations. Here the source is coming just from the variation of theta. In particular, you know, so the way this ends up playing a role in the real world so far is that if you have some sort of topological material like in condensed matter physics, in particular like a so-called topological insulator, turns out has inside the material it has theta equals pi, and outside the material it has theta equals zero, and at the boundary here, there, theta has to vary. It may vary very sharply. And so as a consequence, at the boundary, there are non-zero source terms here that cause important physical effects as you follow the electromagnetic fields from one side to the other. And so just to say that, I mean, it seems like in cosmology, it seems that there is an interesting question of whether it looks an awful lot like in cosmology, one can analytically continue our space-time back before the bang. And anyway, I happen to be interested in a model that does that and that explains some things that way. And I think it's, yeah, I mean, you might wonder whether there's some interesting point to be made if theta is a constant you know, up here in the region before the bang, and I mean after the bang, sorry, and then some different constant in the region before the bang. Yeah, anyway, just to say, it does have physical effects. I wasn't clear about that earlier in the course, but now I understand why it does, and it seems conceivable that there's some interesting thing to be figured out about what effects those might have on our understanding of cosmology, but I don't know. It could be an interesting thing to think about if you're interested. Okay, but so...
Has there been any observed effects?
There, in the pure vacuum, no. There are these effects of the theta term that are observed in condensed matter physics. There it does play an honest to God role.
In real materials,
yeah, exactly. These topological insulators are genuine things that have been made in the lab. Yeah, exactly. This is just a thought. I mean, it could be that there's some observed effect in the universe that would obtain a nice explanation by thinking about it this way, or maybe there's some other, I don't know. Or maybe there's nothing, I really don't know. It's just a thought. Okay, but so, let's see. So that was all. I just wanted to make a quick side remark about that. Oh, you know, the other thing is I wanted to mention the theta 1 term because just to explain that, so, okay, this term violates parity and time reversal. So how do we see that? Well, let's look. One way to think about it is to look at the, you know, Lorentz force law. So the Lorentz force law is that MA, MX double dot is equal to the force on a charge is equal to its charge times the electromagnetic field it feels plus its velocity across B. That's right, this is x dot, sorry. So you can see under how it should transform under parity. Parity is the symmetry that takes x to minus x. So it will flip the sign of this term. And it will also flip x dot, because if we, yeah, x under x goes to minus x, x dot also goes to minus x dot. And so this term, you see that in order for this equation to be invariant, it should be the case that E transforms to minus E, and B transforms to plus B, because then this term will change sign due to this, this term will change sign due to this, and this term will change sign due to this, changing while this doesn't change. So the whole thing will just pick up an overall minus sign, and so a solution, if one thing was a solution, its parity reverse will still be a solution. Under time reversal, now we want to take t to minus t. So this is d dt, this is d squared x dt squared. So there's two t's in the denominator, so when we do t to minus t, nothing happens here. So we want nothing to happen here also, so e should go to plus e now. And here we have dx dt, so that flips sign, but we want nothing to happen to all the terms, so b should also flip to cancel that minus sign. Okay, so that's a kind of quick way to find for yourself how the fields should transform in electromagnetism. And then if you look at the ordinary Maxwell term, the ordinary kinetic term for the Maxwell field, it's like f mu nu, f mu nu. Well, if you just expand out what this is, if you just use the fact that F0I is, you know, EI and FIJ is, you know, F12 is B3, you know, FIJ, IJK, BK, then when you expand this thing out, it's like, it's proportional to E vector squared plus B vector squared. Whereas, or actually, wait a minute. Now I forget. Maybe this is actually minus b squared. But the point for this argument, anyway, it's easy to check. And for this argument, it actually doesn't matter. The point is that this one goes as e squared, so under either of these two transformations, this is invariant, and this term is invariant, whereas this other term, which goes like alpha, beta, you know, the other term, which goes like FF dual, our theta term, that's proportional to E dot B. And so you see it is not invariant under either of these transformations, because here E transforms while B doesn't. So E dot B picks up a minus sign, or here E doesn't transform, but B does. So again, E dot B picks up a minus sign. So, you know, anyway, so this term violates both P and T. And then since CPT is, there's this famous theorem that it is will be satisfied by a local Lorentz invariant theory. This means if P is violated, so is the rest, CT. And so if T is violated, so is CP. And so in particular, okay, so this term violates all of these symmetries, and so in principle, if you just demand that the theory is invariant under any one of these symmetries, that's enough to set that term to zero. Okay, so now let's move on to the strong force. So the strong force, the strong term is very analogous. Okay, for you know, again, one can define the zero I components to be the electric fields, and the ij components to be the magnetic fields. And then once again, this is it's again the case that this thing is proportional to theta 3 times E dot B, where the dot is a sum again over the spatial indices ijk. And again, it is the case that it's the same argument. There's just these extra indices hanging around. But so the point is, this term again violates all of those symmetries. And now the problem is that if this term is non-zero, it gives an non-zero electric dipole moment to the neutron it allows a non-zero electric dipole for the neutron, which is not observed. And I'll explain a little bit more about that in 1 second. And so you might say, well, okay, let's just impose parity or time reversal symmetry on the theory and just set that term to zero. Apparently that's what observations are telling us. And the problem is just that we know that this is part of a bigger standard model Lagrangian, and it's coupled to the rest of a bigger standard model Lagrangian that we know violates both of those symmetries. It violates parity because in our table where we write down the charges for the left and right-handed fields in the standard model, the right-handed fields transform one way and the left-handed fields transform the other way. You know, the left-handed fields feel a weak force, the right-handed fields don't. So it just maximally completely violates parity. It violates CP. It turns out I haven't had a chance to discuss CP in detail, but that it violates CP, it turns out even before this term came along, it already violated CP as soon as we put in three generations And so we weren't able to soak up all of the complex coefficients. We weren't able to make all of the coefficients in the Lagrangian real by appropriate phase rotations. Instead, we ended up with an unremovable complex phase in the CKM matrix. So Kobayashi and Moskawa realized that there were three generations because they wanted to explain the observed CP violation seen in colliders in the standard model, and they realized that you would have that unremovable phase once you had three generations worth of parameters to soak up. Okay, so that's the strong CP problem. Why is it that although the laws of nature as a whole don't violate parity and although the laws of nature as a whole do violate parity and time reversal, the strong force and the strong sector of the standard model seems to not. How does it manage to do it? How does it manage to keep itself shielded from the rest of the standard model? So that's a very elegant puzzle that deserves an elegant solution. And so there are really four solutions that have been proposed to that, and I want to try to explain those quickly. So solution one is that maybe sometimes I'm tempted to get chatty on the board, but it's a big mistake because I write very slow. I have to be careful about it. So solution one is that maybe the up quark is massless. You know, it's a tricky thing because on the one hand, I write slow, so I can't write out everything as I'm saying it. On the other hand, I'm also not coordinated. I mean, it's the same problem, basically. One manifestation of lack of coordination is the thing I just said. Then the other one is that I can't, you know, some people can say one thing and write another thing. I can't do that either. So anyway, what to do? I know what to do. Let's pause and have a have our 1 minute break. Does anyone have a joke?
I don't have a joke, but I don't want to derail with a different question. At the start, you wrote this thing called LSM.
Yes.
I'm not very familiar with it. Is it like a gauge theory? Does it have some sort of table, how the fields transform? Or?
That's a very funny joke. That's very good. That's a new kind of joke, the making fun of the teacher joke. That's very, very good. I like it. I really like it. Okay, great. That was...
We didn't write the table.
Yeah, that's good. Thank you, Justin. Okay, so solution one, the massless up quark. Very funny joke, really. Yeah, you know, it's a kind I didn't foresee. Okay. The second is the parity solution, basically. Find a way to make parity be respected after all. The third option is the so-called CP solution. Find a way to make CP be solved after all. And then the fourth is the axion or Pecci-Quinn solution. Which is somehow to say that, actually theta is not a constant after all, it's a scalar field, it's a new dynamical variable in the theory, and find a reason that that dynamical variable should relax to zero, that somehow it's zero at the bottom of its potential. Okay, so let's try to describe those. So the first one, the massless up quark, so what's the idea? You know, I will be writing a similar table later in the lecture, just for your, this was even planned even before you asked, but I now will consider it a favor to you. this whole argument here, where this whole argument where we had certain we had certain phases that we could absorb, and then after we absorbed as many as we could, we had only a certain set of four phases, the baryon phase and the three lepton number phases, that we could, three remaining phases that were global symmetries of the action that was left over that did nothing to those parameters. Well, the fact that those were the only four phase rotations that we could do, and in particular the fact that none of them changed, none of those rotations had any effect on this term, that was implicitly assuming, actually, if you think about it, that was implicitly assuming that all of the Yukawa couplings, YUI, all of the three YUIs, all of the three YDIs, and all of the three YEIs were all non-zero. Or in other words, that all of the three up type masses and the three down quark masses and the three charged lepton masses were all non-zero. Okay? If one of them had been zero, we would have more freedom. So remember at tree level, we said that the masses of the up quarks were just the Higgs-Vev over root 2 times the up quark Yukawa, the corresponding up quark Yukawa, YU. So suppose the first one, okay, generation one, generation one here is the thing you normally, so when we go through generation one, two, and three, we're talking about the up, charm, and top quark. So let's look at generation one. If the up quark was massless, or in other words, if this first Yukawa coupling was actually zero, then we would have additional freedom. If you think about it, we would now, if you look at that term, if in that three by three diagonal YU matrix, the top entry was actually zero, now the fact that it was non-zero was the reason why when we transformed Q1, Q left one, and U right one, we had to transform them with the same phase, or else that non-zero diagonal component would pick up a phase if we transform them with different phases. But if it's zero, a phase times zero is still zero. So we're allowed to transform the right and left-handed quarks in that term separately. And so in particular, we can just transform U right. If its Yukawa coupling is zero, if YU1 is zero, then that means that the first generation up quark, we're free to transform it with a separate phase, e to the I beta UR1. And so now this is a chiral rotation of a field, in other words, it's a rotation where we're rotating the right-handed quarks differently than the left-handed quarks. In particular, we're rotating a right-handed quark, we're not rotating any left-handed quarks. And this is a field that talks to the strong force. So it'll give a non-zero contribution that looks like this, and if we rotate it by the right amount, we can just cancel off this term. So if the right-handed up quark were massless, or really more specifically, if this Yukawa coupling were zero, then the strong CP problem would be solved. This would be an unphysical term, just like the corresponding one for the weak theta 2 angle. I wrote the wrong thing in my notes here, but okay. So is the up quark zero? Well, if you look in the particle data book, the mass of the up quark is 2 plus or minus 0.5 MeV. So it is very light compared to the other quarks. So here, compare this to the top quark mass. which is 200 GeV, or in other words, about 100,000 times smaller, 100,000 times larger than that. So it's very close to zero, in a sense, compared to the other quark masses, but it seems to be non-zero. Now, but its status, its non-zero status is a bit different from the, for example, these masses, some of these masses, the electron mass, for example, is even quite a bit smaller. But electron, the lepton sector of the Standard Model, because it doesn't talk to the strong force, is so pristine that we know very clearly that all of the YEs are non-zero. So we can't get away with setting any of them to zero. But things are much messier in the strong force, where things are confined. And so in practice, this is actually measured from lattice gauge theory simulations of QCD. And it's a very difficult business. And in particular, there is expected to be a difference between the tree level mass, the mass, let's the I don't know what you want to call this, the bare mass, the mass that is defined to be the Higgs-Vev times the corresponding Yukawa coupling, and the mass that they measure from simulations in lattice QCD. They can differ by instanton effects. And those cannot be calculated explicitly, but they have been estimated to be of this same order. So it is a matter of long-running controversy whether it's clear that the lattice mass of the in QCD is non-zero. But it is less clear, and it's a subject of ongoing controversy, whether YU is non-zero, or, and another point to say is that YU runs with scale. It turns out to be enough if YU was zero at some energy scale, maybe not at the electroweak scale, but if it was non-zero at some energy scale, that turns out to be sufficient to solve the strong CP problem. So that would be the most minimal and elegant solution of the strong CP problem. And it's interesting to note, but anyways, as I say, it's a matter of controversy whether you can get away with this solution. But I just will note that I think it's interesting, and something that we pointed out as part of a PRL last year was that the same Z2 symmetry. So, if it is zero, then suddenly the Standard Model has a new Z2 symmetry, global Z2 symmetry, under sending this field U right one to minus itself. Or you could view it the other way. You could say, really, this is a symmetry of nature, and because that symmetry is present, that's why the up quark is massless. And then we've previously discussed how the leptons in the Standard Model are really just sort of colorless analogs of the quarks. So you could ask, well, what about the corresponding Z2 symmetry in the lepton sector? Nu right one goes to minus nu right one. Well, it turns out that is exactly the symmetry that you need. That's exactly the symmetry. So I was saying that if you consider the Standard Model, the minimal Standard Model with no right-handed neutrinos, there's no dark matter candidate in there. There's simply no stable particle that's also dark, that we haven't already seen. But I also said that for many reasons, both theoretical and cosmological and phenomenological, I personally think it's more likely than not that the correct model is the new Standard Model. I think that it's likely that the Standard Model is augmented by a right-handed neutrino in every generation. And in that model, you can say, oh, is there any dark matter candidate in that model? And there's a unique one. One of the right-handed neutrinos can still be the dark matter. It's still compatible with everything we know. And it turns out that exactly this, if it is going to be the dark matter, it has to be stable. And exactly this symmetry is exactly what you need to stabilize it. So it's kind of a cute thing that that the same symmetry in the lepton sector that turns one of the last remaining possibility in the standard model into a dark matter candidate is an analog of the symmetry that in the quark sector could solve the strong CP problem. So anyway, I kind of think that's an interesting point. So I'm maybe sort of leaning towards this first explanation, but that would certainly be the most minimal possibility. But there are other solutions which are interesting for other reasons. Okay, so to explain the other solution,
One thing about this, since we know all the other fermions in the standard model now are massive, doesn't this just now kind of seem like a weird thing to impose? Because then don't we have the massless up quark problem? Like why we have one fermion in the standard model which is massless?
Well, so normally if you can set something, if you can set some parameter to be the value you want by invoking as a consequence of a symmetry principle, that has a different status than having to set it to zero even when there's no, having to tune it to a particular special value even when there's no symmetry principle to set it to that value. So the advantage of the up quark solution is that there's a symmetry that's compatible with all the other symmetries of the standard model that would set it to zero. Whereas the problem with the normal problem with the strong CP problem is that there's no symmetry that's compatible with the other symmetries that we know the standard model to have that would set it to zero. So in that sense,
That's the Z2, you mean?
The Z2, yeah. The Z2 doesn't conflict with any known symmetries that are broken in the standard model, whereas the point is P or T could set theta to zero, but we know we can't, well, I'll qualify that statement in a minute, but what we can't do, we know those symmetries are broken in the standard model.
So it's safe because you promoted it to an exact symmetry, basically, or because you found a symmetry that rationalizes it.
Yes, it seems to have a better status in that sense. Yeah. Okay. So now I agree. It would be. Yeah. With any of these symmetries, either the SU3 times SU2 times U1 or the Z2, it would be great to not just have to pull symmetries out of a hat, but to know really where they came from and to have an even deeper justification for them. But for none of those, or for Lorentz invariants for that matter, but for none of those symmetries do we have a deeper understanding. The status at the moment is always that we start by positing certain symmetries and looking what the consequences are. Okay. So for the remaining three problems, it's helpful to give first a classical description of a classical picture of what the strong CP problem is and then what the three solutions are. There's kind of a cartoon picture one can draw here. So, you know, classically, this is the neutron. And classically, it consists of an up quark and two down quarks. The bound state of an up quark and two down quarks. Okay, so let's say here's the up quark and here's my two down quarks. Okay, and then classically calculating the dipole moment. Well, the dipole moment is just given by the sum over all the particles of their positions times their charges. That's how the electric dipole moment is defined. And notice that since the total charge here is zero, it doesn't matter what I choose as the origin when I define the positions, because if I shifted, imagine I shifted all of the RIs, I changed the origin so that every RI went to RI plus some common capital R, the change in the position of the origin, well, then that capital R times the sum over QIs, well, that would just be R times the total charge, which would be zero. So the dipole moment we can choose anywhere is the origin. So it's kind of convenient to choose here the up quark to lie at the origin. Okay, so here are my two displacements, and let me define it. It'll be convenient to define, instead of the angle here, to define the complement of that to be the angle theta. So then if you just do this classical estimate of what the dipole moment is, you get that the dipole moment of the neutron is, its absolute value is the charge of the down quark times the radial separation times the square root of 1 minus cosine theta. This would have been 1 plus cosine theta if we defined this to be theta, but because it's 1 minus cosine theta with the dimensions I've drawn there. Okay, so this we know. Now we also know that the size of a neutron is, the size of the bound state is a Fermi. In other words, 1 femtometer. So R is roughly 10 to the minus 15 meters or 10 to the minus 13 centimeters. So we get this estimate from this classical picture that the electric dipole moment of the neutron is of order, the electric charge of the electron. Oh, I think I missed a factor of root 2 here. Anyway, so the electric charge of the electron times a Fermi times this factor 1 minus cosine theta. But then again, the measured thing is much smaller. It's something like E times 10 to the minus 26 centimeters. And so the question is, in this formula, to make this expression small, it seems that we have to make theta very close to 0, because then cosine theta almost cancels 1. So if we would have a, to leading order, this would become theta squared. And so when we pull that out, it's like the leading order, we can just rewrite this thing as theta, or theta over root 2. And so the question is, why is theta not order unity, but instead, 10 to the minus, less than 10 to the minus 13? Okay, something, the actual constraint on theta is actually 10 to the minus 9, so this calculation that I've done here is not quite accurate, because here it seems to be giving theta less than 10 to the minus 13, but okay, at a cartoon level, it's okay. And so it looks like we can, so let's try out our three remaining solutions, the parity solution, the CP solution, and the Pecci-Quinn solution. What do they look like in this picture? Well, so parity the idea is that, okay, before I even say that, so by Lorentz invariance, the neutron is some particle, and it has a spin pointing in some direction. By Lorentz invariance, this is another vector, and there's only one preferred direction for it to point. So it has to point along the direction of S. It has to be proportional to S. In other words, if you go into the rest frame in the neutron, it's just a particle sitting there. It's a quantum state sitting there. It has a preferred direction for its, it has some direction in which its spin pointing is pointing, but then it's axially symmetric around that direction. So the only compatible direction for this thing to point is either parallel or anti-parallel to S. Okay, so the parity solution let's say that it's, there's some proportionality constant gamma here. So parity solution goes as follows. Under parity, x goes to minus x. So if you think about this formula, all these positions go to minus themselves while the charges, nothing happens to them. So d goes to minus d. Whereas the spin, angular momentum, remember, is a pseudo-vector under parity. It's one way to think about it is that it's some sort of R cross P, and R goes to minus R under parity. P is like dr dt. It goes to minus itself under parity. So these both go to minus, and so that goes to itself. And so that would be saying, well, if every neutron has a dipole moment that's gamma times its spin, but then we parity transform it, we get another allowed state of the neutron where, since this flips sign, but this doesn't, that would be like saying that now this constant has flipped sign. Well, there would have to be two species of neutrons. Well, we don't observe two species of neutrons. There's one species of neutron. So if parity was a good symmetry, the only way for this to be equal to both plus and minus gamma s would be for gamma to be zero. Okay, so parity, if parity was a good symmetry, at this classical level, we can see that that would set gamma equal to zero. Alternatively, there's the closely analogous solution for the CP solution. Again, CP is equivalent under the CPT theorem to time reversal. So under time, t goes to minus t. Well, now, this expression doesn't involve t at all, so nothing happens. D goes to itself. But the spin, you know, if it was spinning forward, now it's spinning backwards when you reverse the time. So s goes to minus s. In other words, r goes to itself, but p goes to minus p, so s goes to minus s. And so the same argument as before. We only observe one species of neutron. So either parity or time reversal, if they were good symmetries of nature, would be enough to set gamma equal to zero. In this language, okay, so that's the cartoon classical picture of what the parity and time reversal solutions will, how they'll work. And then the axion idea is, instead of invoking a symmetry, so what we want, remember what we want here to get dn equal to zero is we want theta equal to zero. Or in other words, we want to find that for some reason the actual configuration of the actual classical configuration of the neutron is that the down quark, up quark, and down quark lie in a line with theta equal to zero. So the idea is the axion introduces a new degree of freedom, or unfortunately, usually it involves a lot of new degrees of freedom. But anyway, at low energies, one new degree of freedom that makes this angle theta not a constant of nature, but a degree of freedom. And the idea is that this thing would just dynamically relax to a configuration. You try to find a model in which this dynamically relaxes to a configuration where these two guys are as far apart as possible, which is analogous to what happens with the CO2 molecule, where you have oxygen and then the two carbons. I'm sorry, you have carbon and the two oxygens. Diametrically opposite to one another, alternatively H2O. There, you know, that's an example of a molecule where something different happens. The two H's don't lie on a line. The idea of the axion model classically is to look for something that classically relaxes to that dynamically relaxes to a configuration like that. Okay, so now let me describe the parity solution in more detail. I'll begin that. I won't get very far. So what we'd like is to somehow have promote the standard model to a model with that does have good parity symmetry, that does respect parity, and hopefully do that in a way that agrees with observations and is as elegant as possible. Okay, so you know, normally the problem is that the basic problem with parity in the standard model is that it's left-right asymmetric. As we said before, the left-handed fermions feel the weak force. They transform under SU2. The right-handed fermions do not. So the minimal left-right symmetric model, which is a long-studied model in physics and in beyond the standard model physics, is just to promote the theory to, in the minimal way, to a left-right symmetric one by we leave SU3 as it is. We leave SU2 as it is, but we now call it SU2 left. The left-handed particles still transform under it the same way as before. But now, just like we grouped up left and down left into a doublet under this, we're going to group up right and down right into a doublet under a second SU2, which we'll call SU2 right. And then it turns out that we still want our U1, but it should be U1 B minus L. And now it'll turn out that when this thing breaks, spontaneously breaks, it breaks down to U1 hypercharge. And so we get back the standard model we know and love. Okay. So the idea, Justin, this is for you. Welcome. The idea is to, now we imagine, in other words, the particles in the standard model are the following. The gauge group is SU3, SU2 left, SU2 right, and U1 B minus L. So now, as before, we have the left-handed quark doublet, up left and down left. It's still a triplet under SU3. As before, it's a doublet under SU2, but it doesn't seem to feel the right-handed force. It's a singlet under SU2 right, and its baryon number, as usual, is a third. But then we take the remaining two quarks, up right and down right, we put them into a quark doublet called Q right. It's also a triplet, but now it transforms under the other SU2. Okay, and it has, and these are still a third of a baryon. And we do the analogous thing with the leptons. In addition to our ordinary lepton, which was an SU3 singlet, transformed under SU2 right, but we don't want it to transform under transformed under SU2 left, but we don't want it to transform under SU2 right also, or else we'd get too many fermions here. We'd get 2 times 2 or something like that. We only want 2. So it's a singlet under SU2 right, and it's baryon minus lepton number, so it's a lepton, so its minus lepton number is -1. And then the corresponding right-handed lepton is a singlet under SU3, and now again it transforms under the right-handed guy instead of the left-handed guy. And then the final thing is that in addition to the ordinary Higgs doublet, which is a singlet under SU3, a doublet under SU2, and had some hypercharge. Well, let's call that H left. So it doesn't transform under SU2 right. And it has, let's be agnostic at the moment about what its hypercharge is. Let's call it, what its baryon minus lepton number is. Let's call it X left. And then there's the corresponding right-handed mirror of this particle. Okay, so, well, I should probably stop. But so that's the model, and it's a kind of nice, rather minimal extension of the standard model. No new fermions, just a little bit of extra gauge symmetry, and one extra scalar field. And we'll see that has a number of nice things it does. It gives a very elegant explanation for why the strong CP term is gone, and why, or more generally, why the neutron dipole moment vanishes. And then it also explains a number of other things. It can fix gauge coupling unification, and it actually has a number of other things that it may explain. So it's a cute model. I'll describe the rest of that next time.